Chapter 20. Let the sun warm the day. If light holds all the colors, then see the union as pure and free of compromise. Walk the stone and burden of earth with its manes like cats lying in wait as the wind slips silken and slides round the curl of your sure vision. Let the sun warm this day, armored against all argument, solid in sanctity to opinion. The hue does not deceive, and the blur hides no thought to partake of grey masses in the sky, lowering horizon's rim, where each step is balanced on the day's birth. Wake to the warmth of the sun. It knew other loves past, and stole all the colours from eternal promises. The dust only flows to life in the lost treasure golds of light. Hold to nothing new, for even the new is old and burden-worn. Let the sun bring forth the day. You have walked this way before, amid hunters in the grasses, and wheeling lovers of death crowning every sky. The armies have pursued anon, riders risen along the ridge. Maids and courtiers abide in future's perfect shadows until what is lost returns. Lay of Wounded Love, Fisher.
It's no simple thing, he said, frowning as he worked through his thoughts. But in the world, among people, that is, society, culture, nation, in the world, then, there are attackers and there are defenders. Most of us possess within ourselves elements of both, but in a general sense a person falls to one camp or the other, as befits their nature.
The wind swept round the chiselled stone. What guano remained to stain the dark pitted surfaces had been rubbed thin and patchy, like faded splashes of old paint. Around them was the smell of heat lifting from rock, caught up, spun and plucked away with each gust of the breeze. But the sun did not relent its battle, and for that, Ryad Eles was thankful. Siltras Ruin's eyes were fixed on something to the northwest, but an outcrop of shaped stone blocked Ryad's line of sight in that direction. He was curious, but not unduly so. Instead, he waited for Siltras to continue, knowing how the white-skinned Tistandi sometimes struggled to speak his mind. When it did come, it often arrived all at once and at length, a reasoned, detailed argument that Ryad received mostly in silence. There was so much to learn.
This is not to say that aggression belongs only to those who are attackers, Siltras resumed. Far from it, in fact. In my talent with the sword, for example, I am for the most part a defender. I rely upon timing and counterattack. I take advantage of the attacker's forward predilections, the singularity of their intent. Counterattack is, of course, aggression in its own way. Do you see the distinction?
Ryad nodded. I think so.
Aggression takes many forms. Active, passive, direct, indirect. Sudden as a blow, or sustained as a siege of will. Often it refuses to stand still, but launches upon you from all possible sides. If one tactic fails, another is tried, and so on.
Smiling, Ryad said, Yes, I played often enough among the Imas children. What you describe every child learns, at the hands of the bully and the rival.
Excellent. Of course you are right. But bear in mind, none of this belongs solely within the realm of childhood. It persists and thrives in adult society. What must be understood is this. Attackers attack as a form of defense. It is their instinctive response to threat, real or perceived. It may be desperate or it may be habit or both, when desperation becomes a way of life. Behind the assault hides a fragile person.
He was silent then, and Ryad understood that Siltras sought to invite some contemplation of the things just said. Weighing of self-judgment, perhaps. Was he an attacker or a defender?
He had done both, he knew, and there had been times when he had attacked when he should have defended, and so too the other way round.
I do not know which of the two I am, not yet, but I think I know this much. When I feel threatened, I attack.
Cultures tend to invite the dominance of one over the other, as a means by which an individual succeeds and advances, or conversely fails and falls. A culture dominated by attackers, and one in which the qualities of attacking are admired, often overtly encouraged, tends to breed people with a thick skin, which nonetheless still serves to protect a most brittle self. Thus the wounds bleed, but stay well hidden beneath the surface. Cultures favoring the defender promote thin skin and quickness to take offense, its own kind of aggression, I am sure you see. The culture of attackers seeks submission and demands evidence of that submission as proof of superiority over the subdued. The culture of defenders seeks compliance through conformity, punishing dissenters and so gaining the smug superiority of enforcing silence, and from silence, complicity. The pause that followed was a long one, and Ryad was pleased that it was so, for Silchas had given him much to consider. The Imas? Ah, defenders, I think. Yes, always exceptions, of course. But he said there would be. Examples of both, but in general, yes, defenders. Think of Onrak's fate, his love for Kilava, the crimes that love forced upon him. He defied conformity. He was punished. It was more difficult to think of a culture dominated by attackers. The Lethary? He thought of his father, Udinas. He defends when in himself, but attacks with derision. Yet even then, he does not hide his vulnerability. Is there no third way of being, Silchas? The warrior smiled.
In my long life, Ryad, I have seen many variations, configurations of behavior and attitude, and I have seen a person change from one to the other, when experience has proved damaging enough, or when the inherent weaknesses of one are recognized, leading to a wholesale rejection of it. Though in turn, weaknesses of different sorts exist in the other, and often these prove fatal pitfalls. We are complex creatures, to be sure. The key, I think, is to hold true to your own aesthetics, that which you value, and yield to no one the power to become the arbiter of your tastes. You must also learn to devise strategies for fending off both attackers and defenders. Exploit aggression, but only in self-defense, the kind of self-defense that announces to all the implacability of your armor, your self-assurance, and affirms the sanctity of your self-esteem. Attack when you must, but not in arrogance. Defend when your values are challenged, but never with the wildfire of anger. Against attackers, your surest defense is cold iron. Against defenders, often the best tactic is to sheathe your weapon and refuse the game. Reserve contempt for those who have truly earned it, but see the contempt you permit yourself to feel not as a weapon, but as armor against their assaults. Finally, be ready to disarm with a smile, even as you cut deep with words. Passive. Of a sort, yes. It is more a matter of warning off potential adversaries. In effect, you are saying, be careful how close you tread. You cannot hurt me, but if I am pushed hard enough, I will wound you. In some things, you must never yield. But these things are not eternally changeless or explicitly inflexible. Rather, they are yours to decide upon, yours to reshape if you deem it prudent. They are immune to the pressure of others, but not indifferent to their arguments. Weigh and gauge at all times, and decide for yourself value and worth. But when you sense that a line has been crossed by the other person, when you sense that what is under attack is, in fact, your self-esteem, then gird yourself and stand firm.
Ryad rubbed at the fine hairs, downing his cheeks. Would these words of yours have come from my father, had I remained at home?
In his own way, yes. Udinas is a man of great strength. But great strength, Ryad. He is strong enough to stand exposed, revealing all that is vulnerable within him. He is brave enough to invite you ever closer. If you hurt him, he will withdraw, as he must, and that path to him will be thereafter forever sealed. But he begins with the gift of himself. What the other does with it defines the future of that particular relationship.
What of trust? The red eyes flicked to his and then away again.
I kept them safe for a long time, he said in a low voice, evading the leathery mages and soldiers. None of that was necessary.
My father knew.
I believe Fir Sengar did as well.
So neither then trusted you?
On the contrary, they trusted me to hold to my resolve.
Now it was Ryad's turn to look away. Did she really have to die?
She was never really alive, Ryad. She was sent forth as potential. I ensured that it was realized. Our seeds filled with hope? We might think so. But in truth, hope belongs to the creator of that seed and to those who choose to plant it.
She was still a child to everyone's eyes.
The Azath used what it found.
Is she still alive, then? Silchas Ruin shrugged.
Perhaps more now than ever before. Alive, but young, and very vulnerable.
And so now, Ryad said, my father yearns for the survival of the Azath, and he hopes too for your continued resolve. But maybe hope is the wrong word. Instead, it's trust.
If so, then you have answered your own question.
But what of my resolve? Do you trust in that, Silchas Ruin?
They draw nearer,
the Tist Andi said, rising from his perch on the stone. Then he paused.
Be wary, Ryad. She is most formidable, and I cannot predict the outcome of this parley.
What will she make of me? He asked, also straightening.
That is what we shall discover.
His horse had stepped on a particularly vicious fist of cactus. Torrent dismounted, cursing under his breath. He went round and lifted the beast's hoof and began plucking spines. Olar Athiel stood to one side, watching. It had turned out that escaping the hoary old witch wasn't simply a matter of riding hard and leaving her behind. She kept reappearing in swirls of dust, with that ever-present skull grin that needed no laugh to add sting to its mockery. Following the heavy wagon tracks, he had ridden past two more dragon towers, both as lifeless and ruined as the first one. And now here they were, approaching yet another. Arcane machinery had spilled out from rents in the stone, lying scattered, spreading outward from the foot of the edifice 100 or more paces on all sides. Crumpled pieces of armor and broken weapons lay amidst the wreckage, as well as grizzled strips and slabs of scaled hide. The violence committed at this particular tower remained, intrusive as bitter smoke. Torrent tugged loose the last thorn, and collecting the reins, led the horse forward a few steps.
Those damned things, he said. Were they poisoned?
I think not, Olar Athiel replied. Just painful. Local Bedouin know to avoid stepping on them.
There are no local Bedouin, snapped Torrent. These are the wastelands and well named.
Once, long ago, warrior, the spirits of the earth and wind thrived in this place.
So what happened?
Her shrug creaked.
When it is easy to feed, one grows fat.
What the fuck does that mean?
He faced the tower.
We'll walk for...
Motion in the sky caught his attention as two massive shapes lifted from the enormous carved head of the stone dragon.
Spirits below!
a pair of dragons, real ones. The one on the left was the hue of bone, eyes blazing bright red, and though larger than its companion, it was gaunter, perhaps older. The other dragon was a stunning white, deepening to gold along its shoulders and serrated back. Wings snapping, sailing in a curving descent, the two landed directly in their path, halfway between them and the tower. The earth trembled at the twin impacts. Torrent glanced at Olar Ethil. She was standing still as a statue.
"I thought you knew everything, witch, and now I think you thought the same. Look at you, still as a hare under the cat's eyes."
He looked back in time to see both dragons shimmer and then blur, as if nothing more than mirages. A moment later, two men stood in place of the giant creatures. Neither moved. Even at this distance, Torrent could see how the dragons had so perfectly expressed the essences of these two figures. The one on the left was tall, gaunt, his skin the shade of bleached bone. The other was younger by far, thickly muscled, yet nearing his companion's height. His hair, hanging loose, was gold and bronze, his skin burnished by the sun, and he stood with the ease of the innocent. Saying nothing, Olar Ethil set out to meet them, and to Torrent's eyes she was suddenly diminished, the raw primitiveness of her form looking clumsy and rough. The scaled hide of her cloak now looked to be a faintly sordid affectation. Tugging his skittish horse along behind him, he followed. There was no escaping these warriors, should they desire him harm. If Olar Ethil was prepared to brave it out, then he would follow her lead.
"But this day I have seen true power, and now I will look it in the eye. I have travelled far from my village. The small world of my people gets smaller still."
As he drew closer, he was surprised to see that the two swords belted to the gaunt older warrior were both leathery in design.
"Blue steel. I remember seeing a knife once, traded into the chief's hands, and how it sang when struck."
The younger one bore weapons of flaked stone. He was dressed in strange, rough hides.
"You are not welcome, Silchas," said Olar Ethil. And then she stabbed a gnarled finger at the younger man. "And this one, who so mocks my own people, this is not his world. Silchas Ruin, have you bargained open the gate to Starvald Demolane?"
"He is Menandor's son," replied the white-skinned warrior. "You know the payment for such a bargain, Olar Ethil. Do you think I am prepared to pay it?"
"I do not know what you are prepared to do, Silchas. I never did."
"He is named Ryad Elays, and he is under my protection."
She snorted.
"You think too highly of yourself if you think he requires your protection." "No,"
and she cocked her head.
"I see the truth. You keep him close in order to control him. But since he is Menandor's spawn, you will fail. Silchas Ruin, you never learn. The blood of Elaint can never flow close to its own. There will be betrayal. There is always betrayal. Why does she possess 100 heads? It is to mock an impossible concord."
She shifted slightly to face Ryad Elays.
"He will strike first if he can. When he sees you surpass him, he will seek to kill you."
The young golden warrior seemed unperturbed by her warning.
"He will see no such thing, Bonecaster."
She started and then hissed.
"A bold claim. How can you be so certain?"
"Because," Ryad replied, "I already have." All at once everything shifted. Torrent saw Silchas Ruin step away from his companion, both hands stealing closer to the grips of his swords. Olar Ethil cackled.
"Bonecaster,"
Ryad said, adding a faint bow to the title. "I know your name. I know you are the maker of the ritual of Telan. That without you all, the will of the Imas would have achieved nothing. The one voice was yours. You took a people and stole from them death itself."
"You have dwelt among Tlanimas?"
He shook his head.
Imas, but I know one who was once a Tlan Imas, Onrak the Broken, and I know his wife, Kilava.
Kilava, that sweet bitch. His wife now? She almost undid me. Is she well? Tell her I forgive her, and tell Onrak the Broken of the Logros I shall not reclaim him. His life is his now, and for all time.
It is well you said so, Ryad said, for I have vowed that no harm come to them.
Ryad, Eleis, I have chosen. I am not your enemy, and be glad for that. If I had chosen otherwise, that bold vow would have killed you.
He shrugged. Perhaps between the two of us you would prevail, but against me and Kilava both, the outcome might prove the opposite.
Is she close? No, I sense nothing.
She is the oldest true bonecaster of all, Olar Ithil. The others ceased to grow once they surrendered to the ritual. And look at yourself. The same is true. You are only what you once were, that and nothing more. If Kilava wishes to remain undetected, so it shall be. You do not rule this world, Olar Ithil. You surrendered that privilege long ago with your very own ritual. Olar Ithil swung to Silchas' ruin.
See what you have invited into your shadow, you fool! And now best you beg me for an alliance, quickly!
But Silchas' ruin let his hands fall away from his weapons.
It may be that I have kept him close for the reasons you say, Olar Ithil. But there are other reasons, and these are proving far more compelling the more I come to know this son of Menandor. If he has indeed surpassed me, I will yield my leadership of the pair of us. As for an alliance with you, frankly, I'd rather bed an Enkarl.
Torrent laughed, as much to release the tension and fear building within him as at the notion of this warrior bedding something with the ugly name of Enkarl. The sound, unfortunately, drew everyone's attention. Ryad addressed him.
Warrior, are you indebted to this bonecaster?
He frowned.
I'd not thought of that. Possibly, but I do not know the coin nor its value. I am Torrent of the All, but the All are no more. Instead, I keep company with bones.
The youth smiled, as if unexpectedly pleased with the answer. Silchas said,
Torrent of the All, I grieve for the passing of your people. Their memory rests with you now. Cherish it, but do not let it destroy you.
An interesting distinction, Torrent said after a moment's thought. But I am past such things, since I now cherish destruction. I would slay my slayers. I would end the lives of those who have ended mine.
He glanced across at Olar Ithil.
Perhaps this is the coin between me and this undead witch.
Sorrow tinged Ruin's face, but he said nothing. Ryad's smile was gone.
Look around then, warrior. This is the home you would make for your enemies and for yourself. Does it please you?
I think it does, Ryad Eleis.
The young man's displeasure and disappointment at that answer was plain to see. A short span of silence, and then Olar Ithil spoke.
You have waited to spring this ambush, Silchas Ruin. Were the words we have exchanged all you sought, or is there something else?
My curiosity is satisfied, Silchas said to the bonecaster. But I will give you this as a gesture, if you will, as evidence that I wish no enmity between us. Two undead dragons are seeking you. I know them of old. They will bow and scrape and swear fealty, but in their hearts they are vile.
Olar Ithil sniffed.
I thought I sensed something on our trail. You say you know them, while I do not. I find that odd, given the world you and I once shared.
From when the Elaint were unleashed, out through the gate, seeking to claim realms to rule amidst the shattered remains of Khorald Imulan. He paused and then added, My own encounter with them was brief but violent. They are true spawn of Tiam.
Yet they travel together. Why has neither one committed treachery upon the other?
I believe they are twins, Olar Ethil, hatched from a single egg, as it were. Among all the Elaint during the Wars of Shadow, they came closest to victory. It was the last time I stood beside my brother, the last time he held my flank and I his. For a time, then, and his voice fell away, we were happy.
Though Torrent knew nothing of these Wars of Shadow, nor the other players involved, he could not but hear the sorrow in Ruin's voice, and it stung him deep inside.
Fucking regrets. We all have them, don't we? Live long enough, and maybe it's all we have. All we keep alive in our minds. Spirits below, what a miserable thought.
But Olar Ethil had no room in her bag of bones for sentiment. She hacked out a laugh.
Happy delivering death! Oh, you were all such righteous fools back then. And now among you and your brothers only you remain, like a thorn no one can dig loose. Tell me the great cause you have espoused for yourself this time, Silchas Ruin. Tell me about all the regrettable but necessary deaths to shore up your grisly road. Do not think I won't cheer you on, nor this mortal beside me either, if one would purchase truth from his words. You are welcome to mayhem, Silchas Ruin. You and this flawed fire of a child at your side, and Kilava too, for that matter.
At her outburst, Silchas frowned.
Speak what you are hiding, Bonecaster.
Gesture for gesture? Very well. Erastus has summoned the elders. Setul Lath, Kilmandaros, Mael, and now Draconis. Yes, when you hide yourselves so well, you yield your touch on this trembling world. You become blind. Your brother is dead, Silchas Ruin. Dragnipur is shattered. Draconis is loose upon the realm, darkness in his hands. And what does his old lover see now that she sets eyes upon us all once more? Have you greeted your mother yet, Silchas? Have you felt her touch upon your brow? I thought not. She grieves for the son she cherished the most, I think, in whom the black flames of her love burned brightest. She reserves true spite and contempt for...
Torrent's backhanded swing caught her full in the face, hard enough to knock her from her feet, falling in a clatter of bones. As he loomed over her, he found he'd drawn his sword.
Spite, witch? Well, you'd know of it better than anyone. Now shut that bony jaw and keep it shut.
Her black-pitted eyes seemed to fix upon his own as if baring claws, but he did not flinch.
Destruction? You scrawny bitch. I fear only its escape.
He stepped back and shot Silchas a glance. The man looked so wounded it was a wonder he was still standing. He had wrapped his arms about his own torso, curled in and shrunken. The liquid that leaked down from his eyes traced crimson glints down his hollowed cheeks. Torrent saw Ryad, his face ravaged with distress, take a step towards his companion, and then he wheeled to advance on Olar Ethil. Torrent stepped into his path.
Go back, he said. Now is not the time. Console your friend, Ryad. I will lead her away from here.
The young warrior trembled, his eyes incandescent with fury.
She will not.
Heed me? She will. Ryad, the attacks are over.
He started, eyes widening.
Attacks?
Then he nodded.
Yes, I see.
Yes, he nodded again, and then turned round, ready to give his youthful strength to an old man suddenly broken.
And so he surpasses, and leadership now belongs to him. Simple as that.
Torrent sheathed his sword and swung up onto his horse. He gathered the reins, shot one last withering look upon Olar Ethil, who'd yet to move, and then kicked his mount into motion. On to the trail of the wagon, east and south. He did not look back, but after a time he saw a spinning cloud of dust lift from a nearby rise. She was with him.
I see you, sweet as crotch rot. But will you even admit I probably just saved your sorry sack? Didn't think so.
As the sun painted gold the brutal facing of the stone tower, a figure of gold and bronze stood above another who knelt, bowed forward over his thighs with his face in his hands. Neither moved until long after the sun set and darkness claimed the sky. There had been an old man among the Bargast, brain-addled and prone to drag onto his shoulders a tattered, mangy wolf hide, and then fall to his hands and knees, as if at last he had found his true self. A beast incapable of speech beyond yips and howls, he would rush in amongst the camp dogs, growling, until he had subdued every bewildered, cowering animal. He had sought to do other things as well, but Setoc found even the memory of those to be too pitiful and painfully pathetic to revisit. The giant plains wolf, Ball Jag, reminded her of that old man. Hide patched and rotted, in places hanging in mangled strips, its muzzle was perpetually peeled back, revealing the massive oak-hued teeth and fangs, as if the entire world deserved an eternal challenge. The creature's black pitted eye-holes haunted her, speaking to her in eloquent silence. I am death, they said. I am your fate and the fate of all living things. I am what is left behind. Departed from the world, I leave you only this. She wondered what had happened to that old man, to make him want to be a wolf. What wound stuck in his mind made him lose all sense of his true self? And why was there no going back, no finding that lost self? The mind held too many secrets. The brain was a sack of truths, and their power, hiding there inside, was absolute. Twist one truth into a lie, and a man became a wolf. His flesh and bones could only follow, straining to reshape themselves. Two legs to four, teeth to fangs, new forms and new purposes to give proof to the falsehood. But such lies need not be so obvious as that old man with his broken brain, need they? The self could become lost in more subtle ways, could it not? Today I am this person. Tomorrow I am another. See the truths of me? Not one is tethered. I am bound to no single self, but unleashed into a multitude of selves. Does this make me ill? Broken? Is this why I can find no peace? The twins walked 5 paces in front of her. They were one split in two, sharp-eyed round faces peering into the mirror where nothing could hide. Truths could bend, but not twist. I willingly followed Toc Anister, even as I resented it. I have my very own addiction, and it is called dissatisfaction. And each time it returns, everyone pays. Kafal, I let you down. I cried out my own failure of faith. I forced you to flee me. Where are you now, my soft-eyed priest? Ball Jag's dead eyes fixed on her again and again as they walked. She lagged behind the twins. The boy's weight was making the muscles of her arms burn. She would have to set him down again, and so their pace would suddenly slow to a crawl. Everyone was hungry. Even an undead wolf could find little to chase down out here. The withered grasses of the plains were long behind them now. Soil had given way to stones and hard-packed clay. Thorny shrubs clung here and there, their ancient trunks emerging from beds of cacti. Worn watercourses revealed desiccated pieces of driftwood, mostly no more substantial than the bones of her forearm, but occasionally they came upon something far larger, long and thick as a leg, and though she could not be certain, she thought that they showed signs of having been worked. Boreholes large enough to insert a thumb, though of course to do so would invite a spider's bite or a scorpion's sting, and the faint scaly signs of adze marks. But none of these ancient streams could have borne a boat of any kind, not even a skiff or raft. She could make no sense of any of it. The north horizon hinted at high towers of stone, like mountains gnawed through from every side, leaving the peaks tottering on narrow spires. They made her uneasy, as if warning her of something. "You are in a land that gives nothing. It will devour you, and there is no end to its vast hunger." They had made a terrible mistake. No, she'd made it. "He was leading us east, so we will go east. Why was he leading us in that direction? Stavi, I have no idea. But here is a truth I have found inside myself. All that dissatisfaction, it's not at Tok, it's not at anyone, it's with me. My inability to find peace, to trust it when I do find it, and to hold on to it. This addiction feeds itself. It may be incurable." Another rutted watercourse ahead. No, Setok's eyes narrowed. Two ruts churned up by horse hoofs. A track. The twins had seen the same, for they suddenly ran ahead, halting and looking down. Setok didn't catch their words, but both turned as she arrived, and in their faces they saw a hardening determination. Story pointed.
"It goes that way! It goes that way, Setok! So will we!"
Stavi added. Southeast, but curving ahead, she saw.
"Eastward. What is out there? What are we supposed to find?"
"Blah, blah, blah, blah!"
cried the boy, his loud voice so close to one ear, making her flinch. Balljag trotted out to sniff the trail.
"Probably just instinct. The damned thing hasn't even got a working nose. Has it? Maybe it smells different things, life or something else."
When the twins set out on the path, the huge beast followed. The boy twisted in Setok's arms and she lowered him to the ground. He ran to join his sisters.
"Some leader I am."
At the turn, she saw skid marks, where the wagon's wheels had spun and juddered out to the side, tearing at the ground. Here the horse hoofs had gouged deep, but she could see no obstacle that would have forced such a maneuver. The way ahead ran straight for 100 paces before jagging south again, only to twist east and then northeast. At this, Setok snorted.
"They were out of control," she said. "They went where the horses dragged them. This is pointless."
Stavi spun.
"We don't care where they're going," she shouted. "It doesn't matter."
"But how can they help us if they can't even help themselves?" Setok asked.
"What's so different about that?"
"The bitchy little runt has a point.
Look at those marks. They were riding wild, crazy fast. How do you expect we'll ever catch them?" "Because horses get tired."
They resumed their journey, tracking the aimless with purpose,
just like growing up.
Stones crunched underfoot, the bridling heat making the gnarled stalks of the shrubs tick and creak. They were low on water. The meat of the lizards they'd eaten this morning felt dry and sour in Setok's stomach. Not a single cloud in the sky to give them a moment's respite. She couldn't recall the last time she'd seen a bird. Noon passed, the afternoon stretching as listless as the wasteland spreading out on all sides. The track had finally straightened out on an easterly setting. Even the twins were slowing down. All of their shadows had pitched round and were lengthening when Story cried out and pointed. A lone horse, south of the trail by 200 or so paces, remnants of traces dangled down from its head. It stood on weak legs, nuzzling the lifeless ground, and its ebon flanks were white with crusted lather. Setok hesitated and then said,
"Keep Balljag here. I want to see if I can catch it."
For once the twins had no complaint. The animal was facing away, but it caught some noise or scent when Setoc was still 100 paces off, and it shifted round to regard her. Its eyes, she saw, were strange, as if swallowed in something both lurid and dark. At least the animal didn't bolt.
"Ghost wolves, stay away from me now. We need this beast."
Cautiously, she edged closer. The horse watched. It had been eating cactus, she saw, and scores of spines were embedded in its muzzle, dripping blood.
"Hungry, starving,"
she spoke in low, soothing tones.
"How long have you been out here, friend? All alone, your companion's gone. Do you welcome our company? I'm sure you do. As for those spines, we'll do something about that. I promise."
And then she was close enough to reach out and touch the animal, but its eyes held her back. They didn't belong to a horse. They looked demonic.
"It's been eating cactus. How much?"
She looked to where she had seen it cropping the ground.
"Oh, spirits below, if all that is now in your stomach, you are in trouble."
Did it look to be in pain? How could she tell? It was clearly weary, yes, but it drew a steady and deep breath, ears flicking curiously as it in turn studied her. Finally, Setoc slowly reached out to take the frayed leather traces. When she gathered them up, the animal lifted its head, as if about to prod her with its wounded muzzle. Setoc wrapped the reins about her left hand and gingerly took hold of one of the spines. She tugged it loose. The horse flinched. That and nothing more. Sighing, she began plucking. If she licked the blood from the spines, what would the beast think of that? She decided not to find out.
"Oh, but I dearly do want to lick this blood. My mouth yearns for that taste. I can smell its warm life. Old man, give me your skin."
When she'd removed the last spine, she reached up and settled a hand on its blazoned brow.
"Better? I hope so, friend."
"Mercy," said a thin voice in accented trader tongue. "I'd forgotten about that."
Setoc stepped round the horse and saw, lying in a careless sprawl on the ground, a corpse. For an instant, her breath caught.
"Tok?
Who? No. Saw him, though, once. Funny eyes."
"Does nothing dead ever go away around here?"
Setoc demanded, fear giving way to anger.
"I don't know. But can you even hope to imagine the anguish people like me feel when seeing one such as you? Young, flush, with such clear and bright eyes. You make me miserable."
Setoc drew the horse round.
"Wait, help me up. I'm snagged on something. I don't mind being miserable, so long as I have someone to talk to. Being miserable without anyone to talk to is far worse."
"Really?"
Setoc walked over, studied the corpse.
"You have a stake through your chest," she said.
"A stake? Oh, a spoke, you mean. That explains it."
"Does it?"
"Well, no. Things got confused. I believe, however, I am lying on a fragment of the hub, with perhaps another fragment of spoke buried deep in the earth. This is what happens when a carriage gets picked up and then dropped back down. I wonder if horses have much memory. Probably not, else this one would still be running. So, beautiful child, will you help me?"
She reached down.
"Take my arm, then. Can you manage that much? Good. Now hold tight while I try and lift you clear."
It was easier than she'd expected.
Skin and bones don't weigh much, do they?
"I am named Cartographer,"
said the corpse, ineffectually trying to brush dust from his rags.
"Setoc.
So very pleased to meet you."
"I thought I made you miserable."
"I delight in misery,"
she grunted.
You'll fit right in. Come with me.
Wonderful. Where are you going?
We're going after your carriage. Tell me, is everyone in it dead like you?
Cartographer seemed to ponder the question, and then he said,
Probably. But let's find out, shall we?
The children of Onos Tulan and Hetan seemed unaffected by the arrival of yet another animated corpse. When Cartographer saw Balljag, he halted and pointed, but said nothing. Setok took the boy's hand and led him close to the horse. She vaulted onto the animal's back and reached down and lifted up the boy. The twins set out once more on the trail. Balljag fell in with them.
Did you know, Cartographer said, the dead still dream?
No, said Setok. I didn't know that.
Sometimes I dream that a dog will find me.
A dog?
Yes, a big one. As big as that one.
Well, it seems your dream has come true.
I hope not.
She glanced down at him as he trudged beside the horse.
Why?
Because in my dream, the dog buries me.
Thinking back to her vision of Balljag clawing free of the ground, she smiled.
I don't think you have to worry about that. Not with this dog, Cartographer.
I hope you are right. I do have one question, however.
She sighed. A corpse that won't shut up. Go on.
Where are we?
The wastelands.
Ah, that explains it, then.
Explains what?
Why all this waste?
Have you ever heard of the wastelands, Cartographer?
No.
So let me ask you something. Where did your carriage come from, and how is it you don't even know the land you were travelling in?
Given my name, it is indeed pathetic that I know so little. Of course, this land was once an inland sea. But then one might say that of countless basins on any number of continents. So that hardly amounts to brilliant affirmation of my profession. Alas, since dying, I have been forced to radically reassess all my most cherished notions.
Are you ever going to answer my questions?
Our arrival was sudden, but Master Quell judged it propitious. The client expressed satisfaction and indeed no small amount of astonishment. Far better this wretched land than the realm within a cursed sword, and I would hardly be one to dispute that, would I? Maps being what they are and such, naturally, it was inevitable that we let down our guard. Ah, see ahead, ample evidence of that.
The tracks seemed to vanish for 15 or 20 paces. Where they resumed, wreckage lay scattered about, including half an axle. A lost horse and a lost wheel behind them, half an axle here. How had the thing managed to keep going? And what was it doing in that gap? Flying?
Spirits below, Cartographer!
And then she stopped. From her height astride the horse, she could make something out ahead. Daylight was fading, but still,
I see it.
Two more stretches without tracks. Then, where they resumed, various parts of ornate carriage lay strewn about. She saw one large section of painted wood, possibly from the roof, bearing deep gouges scored through it, as if some massive hand had been tearing the carriage to pieces. Some distance ahead rested the carriage itself, or what was left of it. The humped forms of dead horses lay thrown about to the sides.
Cartographer,
it struck from the sky,
the corpse replied.
Was it a dragon? It most assuredly was not. An Enkaral? What Enkaral could boldly lift from the ground the entire carriage and all its horses? No, not an Enkaral. Mind you, I was witness only to the first attack. Tell me, Setok, do you see anyone?
Not yet, she replied. Stavi, Story, hold up there.
She lifted the boy and set him down on the ground.
I will ride ahead. I know it's getting dark, but keep your eyes on the sky. There's something up there. Somewhere. Hopefully not close.
The horse was nervous beneath her, reluctant to draw nearer to the carriage, but she coaxed it on. Its fellow beasts had been torn apart, bones splintered, gouges of flesh missing. Everywhere those same thin but deep slashes, talons, enormous and deadly sharp. She found the first corpse, a man. He had wrapped the ends of the traces about his forearms, and both arms were horribly dislocated, almost pulled free of the shoulders. Something had slashed through his head diagonally from above, she judged. Through his skullcap helm, down along one side of the nose and out beneath the jaw, leaving him with half a face. Just beyond him was another man, neatly decapitated. She couldn't see the head anywhere close by. She halted her mount a few paces from the destroyed carriage. It had been huge, six-wheeled, likely weighing as much as a clan yurt, with the entire family shoved inside. The attacker had systematically dismantled it from one flank, as if eager to get within. Blood stained the edges of the gaping hole it had made. Setup clambered up to peer inside. No body, but a mass of something was heaped on the side that was now the floor, gleaming wet in the gloom. She waited for her eyes to adjust. Then, in revulsion, she pulled back. Entrails. An occupant had been eviscerated. Where was the rest of the poor victim? She perched herself on the carriage and scanned the area. There, half of him anyway, the upper half. And then she saw tracks, the ground scuffed, three or four paths converging to form a broader one, and that one led away from the wreckage, eastward.
Survivors. But they must have been on the run, else they would have done more for their dead. Still, a few made it, for a little while longer, anyway.
She descended from the carriage and mounted the horse.
Sorry, friend, but it looks like you're the last.
Swinging the horse round, she rode back to the others.
How many bodies?
Cartographer asked when she arrived.
Three, for certain. Tracks lead away.
Three, you say?
That I saw. Two on the ground, one in the carriage, or rather, bits of him left in the carriage.
A man? A man in the carriage?
Yes.
Oh dear. That is very bad indeed.
Returning to the wreckage, cartographer moved to stand over each victim, shaking his head and muttering in low tones, possibly a prayer. Setok wasn't close enough to hear his words. He rejoined her once they were past.
I find myself in some conflict, he said. On the one hand, I wish I'd been here to witness that dread clash, to see Trake's mortal sword truly awakened, to see the Trell's rage rise from the deepness of his soul. On the other hand, witnessing the gruesome deaths of those I had come to know as friends, well, that would have been terrible. As much as it grieves me to say, there are times when getting what one wants yields nothing but confusion. It turns out that what one wants is in fact not at all what one wants. Worse is when you simply don't know what you want. You'd think death would discard such trials, if only it did.
There's blood on this trail, said Setok.
I wish that surprised me. Still, they must have succeeded in driving the demon away, in itself an extraordinary feat.
How long ago did all this happen?
Not long. I was lying on the ground from mid-morning. I imagine we'll find them.
We already have, she said. They've camped.
She could see the faint glow of a small fire, and now figures straightening, turning to study them. The sun was almost down behind Setok and her companions, so she knew the strangers were seeing little more than silhouettes. She raised a hand in greeting, urging her mount forward with a gentle tap of her heels. Two of the figures were imposing, one broad and bestial, his skin the hue of burnished mahogany, his black braided hair hanging in greasy coils. He was holding a two-handed mace. The other was taller, his skin tattooed in the stripes of a tiger, and as Setok drew closer, she saw a feline cast to his features, including amber eyes bisected by vertical pupils. The two heavy-bladed swords in his hands matched the barbed patterns of his skin. Three others were visible, two women and a tall young man. He was long-jawed and long-necked, with blood-matted hair. A knotted frown marred his high forehead above dark, angry eyes. He stood slightly apart from all the others. Setok's eyes returned to the two women, both short and plump, neither one much older than Setok herself, but their eyes looked aged, bleak, dulled with shock. Two more survivors were lying close to the fire, asleep or unconscious. The bestial man was the first to speak, addressing Cartographer, but not in a language that Setok recognized. The undead man replied in the same tongue, and then turned to Setok.
Meppo Runt welcomes you with a warning. They are being hunted.
I know, she said. Cartographer, you seem to have a talent for languages.
Hood's gift for the tasks he set upon me. Meppo addresses me in a Daru dialect, a trader's cant. He does so to enable his companions to understand his words, as they are Jenabakan, while he is not.
What is he, then?
Trell, Setok.
And the striped one, what manner of creature is he?
Drake's mortal sword.
Meaning what?
Ah, Drake is the tiger of summer, a foreign god. Gruntle is the god's chosen mortal weapon.
The one Cartographer had named Gruntle now spoke, his eerie eyes fixed upon Setok. She noted that he had not sheathed his swords whilst the Trell had set down his mace.
Setok, said Cartographer after Gruntle had finally finished, the mortal sword names you Destrian Tefandere and Tog, the wolves of winter. You are, in a sense, kin, another servant of war. Yet though Drake may view you and your lady and lord as mortal enemies, Gruntle does not. Indeed, he says, he holds his own god in no high esteem, nor is he pleased with, well, he calls it a curse. Accordingly, you are welcome and need not fear him. Conversely, Cartographer then added, if you seek violence, then he will oblige your wish.
Setok found her heart was pounding hard and rapid in her chest. Her mouth was suddenly dry.
Destriant, have I heard that word before? Did Tok so name me? Or was it someone else? I am not interested in violence, she said.
When Cartographer relayed her reply, Gruntle glanced once at the undead wolf standing between the twins. All Jag's bristled back was unmistakable. And then the mortal sword momentarily bared impressive fangs, before nodding once and sheathing his weapons. And then he froze as the twins' brother toddled forward, seemingly heading straight for Gruntle.
Clav, 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 clav!
Setok saw the Trell start at that, turning to study the boy who now stood directly in front of Gruntle with arms outspread.
He wants Gruntle to pick him up,
Setok said.
I'm sure Gruntle can see that, said Cartographer. A most fearless child. The word he seeks is Imas. I did not think such things even existed. Imas children, I mean.
Gruntle snatched up the boy, who yelped in delight, filling the night air with laughter. Setok heard Baljag's low growl and glanced over. Although the undead beast made no move, the black pits of its eyes were fixed, as much as could be determined, upon the mortal sword and the child he held.
Getting killed once wasn't enough, she asked the giant wolf. The pup needs no help.
The twins had edged closer to Setok, who now dismounted.
It's all right, she said to them.
Mother said cats were teeth and claws without brains, said Story.
She pointed at Gruntle.
He looks like his mother slept with a cat.
Your brother isn't afraid.
Too stupid to be scared,
said Stavi. These ones, said Setok, fought off the sky demon, but they didn't kill it, else we would have found the carcass. Would we be safer with or without them?
I wish Tok was here.
So do I, Story.
Where were they going anyway? There's nothing in the wastelands.
At Story's question, Setok shrugged. I can't quite get an answer to that yet, but I will keep trying.
The two women had returned to tending their wounded companions. The tall young man remained off to one side, looking agitated. Setok stepped closer to Cartographer.
What is wrong with that man?
It is, I am told, ever a misjudgment to view a bowl of the Moti Regulars with contempt. Ambi is angry, and that anger is slow to fade. His brother is sorely wounded, near death, in fact.
Does he blame Gruntle or Mappo for that?
Hardly. Oh, I gather that both of those you speak of fought valiantly against the Sky Demon. Certainly the mortal sword is made for such encounters. But neither Gruntle nor Mappo succeeded in driving the creature away. The bowls despise such things as demons and the like, and once awakened to anger, they prove deadly against such foes. Precious Thimble calls it a fever, but Master Quell suggested that the bowls themselves are the spawn of sorcery. Perhaps a Jaghut creation gone awry. Would that explain the bowls' extravagant hatred for Jaghut? Possibly. In any case, it was Ambien Jeweler Bowl who sent the demon fleeing. But the residue of that fury remains in Ambi, suggesting that he maintains his readiness should the demon be foolish enough to return.
Setok studied the man with renewed interest and more than a little disbelief.
What did he do to it? Bite it with those huge front teeth?
Cartographer then said,
Earlier you mentioned Tok. We here all know him. Indeed, it was Tok who guided us from the realm of Dragnipur. And Gruntle, why, he once got drunk with Tok Anister. That would be before Tok got himself killed, one presumes.
The twins were listening to this, and Setok saw relief in their eyes.
More friends of Tok. Will that do, girls?
Seemed it would.
Cartographer, what is a Destriant?
Ah, well, a Destriant is one who is chosen from among all mortals to wear the skin of a god.
The skin?
Too poetic? Let me think then. Look into the eyes of 1,000 priests. If there is a Destriant among that 1,000, you will find him or her. How? The truth is in their eyes, for you shall, in looking into those eyes, find yourself looking upon the god's own.
Tok bears a wolf's eye,
because he is the herald of war.
The title chilled her.
Then why is his other eye not a wolf's eye, too?
It was human, I'm sure.
Exactly. Why?
Cartographer made the mistake of scratching his temple and came away with a swath of crinkled skin impaled on his fingernails. He fluttered his fingers to send it drifting away into the night.
Because, I imagine, humans are the true heralds of war, don't you think?
Maybe.
But she wasn't so sure.
Tok was leading us into the east.
If he's the herald of war, as you say, then... Cartographer nodded.
I should think so, Setok. He was leading you to a place and a time where you will be needed.
As Destriant to the wolves of winter, to gods of war.
She looked over to where Baljag stood, just beyond the firelight, deathly and deathly still, the huge teeth forever bared, the eyes forever empty.
The skin of war, and I am to wear it.
Her attention snapped over to Gruntle.
Cartographer?
Yes?
He said he holds his god in no high esteem. He said he calls what he is a curse.
That is true.
I need to talk to him.
Of course, Setok.
The mortal sword had sat down by the fire, with the boy perched on one bouncing knee. The barbed tattoos seemed to have inexplicably faded, as had the feline traits of his features. The man looked almost human now, barring the eyes. There was quiet pleasure in the face.
What would Onos Tulan have made of this? Tok, were you bringing us to these ones?
She sighed. The skin of war. The wolves want me to wear it. But I do not.
Take me to him, please.
Mappo glanced over to see the young woman crouching opposite Gruntle, with cartographer providing translations. No doubt they had much to discuss. An unknown war in the offing, a clash of desperate mortals and perhaps desperate gods.
Andicarium, old friend, you must have no place in what is coming. If thousands needlessly die by your hand, what dire balance would that tip? What cruel fate would that invite? No, I must find you, take you away. Already too many have died on your trail.
He heard a ragged sigh to his left. Angling round, he studied the woman lying on a bedroll.
You will live, Faint, he said.
Then...
You did not reach him in time. If you had, you would be the one now dead, rather than Master Quell.
She reached up to her own face, dragged her nails to scrape away the blood crusting the corners of her mouth.
Better for you if I had. Now we are stranded.
He might have replied, but we are now so close. I can feel him. We are almost there. But that was a selfish thought. Delivering Mappo was but half the task. These poor shareholders needed to find a way home, and now they had lost the one man capable of achieving that. So, to Faint statement, he had nothing to say.
My chest hurts, she said.
The Chimal struck you, its claws scoring deep. I have sewn almost 300 stitches from your right shoulder to below your ribcage on the left.
She seemed to think about that for a moment, and then she said,
So we've seen the last of Faint's bouncing tits.
You did not lose them, if that is what you fear. They will still, bounce, if perhaps unevenly.
So the gods really do exist. Listen, precious Thimble, is she still alive?
Yes.
Then we have a chance.
Mappo winced.
She is young, Faint, mostly untutored.
There's a chance, Faint insisted. Beru's black nipples, this hurts.
She will attempt some healing in a while, said Mappo. It took all of her strength just to keep Jula alive.
Faint grunted and then gasped. Recovering, she said,
Guilt will do that.
Mappo nodded. The Bowl brothers had followed Precious Thimble into this guild, and she had joined on a whim, or more likely, to see how far her two would-be lovers would go in their pursuit of her. When love turned into a game, people got hurt, and Precious Thimble had finally begun to comprehend the truth of that.
You took them too far, didn't you?
At the same time, without the Bowls, none of them here would be alive right now. Mappo still found it difficult to believe that a mortal man's fists could do the damage he'd seen from Jula and Ambi Bowl. They had simply launched themselves onto the winged Chimal, and those oversized knuckles had struck with more power than Mappo's own mace. He had heard bones crack beneath those blows, had heard the Chimal's gasps of shock and pain. When it lashed out, it had been in frantic self-defense, a blind panic to dislodge its frenzied attackers. The creature's talons, each one as long as a Semk scimitar, had plunged into Jula's back, the four tips erupting from the man's chest. It had flung the man away, and at that moment Ambi's lashing fists found the Chimal's throat. Those impacts would have crushed the neck of a horse, and they proved damaging enough to force the Chimal into the air, wings thundering. A backhanded blow scraped Ambi off, and then the thing was lifting upward. Gruntle, who appeared to have been the Chimal's original target,
carried off in the first attack and presumed by the others to be dead, had then returned, an apparition engulfed in the rage of his god. Veered into the form of an enormous tiger, its shape strangely blurred and indistinct, except for the barbs that writhed like tongues of black flame, he had launched himself into the air in an effort to drag down the Chimal. But it eluded him, and then, wings hammering, it fled skyward. Mappo subsequently learned from Gruntle, once his fury was past, something like his human form returning, that his first battle with the thing had been 1,000 reaches above the wastelands, and when the Chimal failed to slay him, it had simply dropped him earthward. Gruntle had veered into his soul-taken form in mid-air. He now complained of bruised, throbbing joints, but Mappo knew it was a fall that should have killed him.
Drake intervened. No other possible explanation serves.
He thought again about that horrifying creature, reiterating his own conviction that it was indeed some breed of Kachain Chimal, though not one he had ever seen before, nor even heard of from those more intimate with the ancient race. It was twice the height of a Kel hunter, although gaunter. Its wingspan matched that of a middle-aged Elaint. Yet where among dragons those wings served to aid speed and direct their manoeuvring in the air, with sorcery in effect carrying the dragon's massive weight, for this Chimal all lift was produced by those wings, and its weight was but a fraction of an Elaint's.
Gods, it was fast, and such strength!
In its second attack, after Gruntle was gone, the Chimal had simply lifted the entire carriage into the air, horses and all. If the carriage's frame had not splintered in its grip, the beast would have carried them all skyward until it reached a height from which a fall would be fatal. Simple and effective, the Chimal had attempted the tactic a few more times before finally descending to do battle, to its regret.
And it must be admitted, ours as well.
Glano Tarp was dead. So too Recanto Ilk. And of course Master Quell. When Mappo had reached the carriage to pull Precious Thimble from the interior cabin, she had been hysterical. Quell had interposed himself between her and the attacking Chimal, and it had simply eviscerated him. If not for the bowls leaping onto its back, it would have slain her as well. Mappo still bore slashes on his hands and wrists from the woman's blind terror. The carriage had proved beyond mundane repair. There had been no choice but to continue on foot, carrying away their wounded, with the threat of another attack ever looming over them.
Still, I think the bowls hurt it. That Chimal, it wasn't out here waiting for us. Its attack was opportunistic. What else could it have been? No, the creature has other tasks awaiting it. For all I know, it too is hunting Icarium. A possibility too terrible to consider. In any case, let us hope it has now concluded we're too much trouble.
His eyes strayed to his mace, lying on the ground close to hand. He had managed to strike the Chimal one solid blow, enough to rock it back a step. It had felt as if his mace had collided with an iron obelisk. His shoulders still ached.
The eye looks past the target to where the weapon is intended to reach. When it fails, shock thunders through the body, every muscle, every bone. I can't even remember the last time it so utterly failed.
Who are these strangers?
Faint asked. Mappo sighed.
I am not sure. There is an undead eye with them.
A what?
An ancient wolf from the age of the Imas. Their bloodline was harvested in the shaping of the Hounds of Shadow, but not the Hounds of Darkness. For those, it was the bloodline of a breed of plains bear, Tynath Okraal, in the language of the Bentrak Dimas.
An undead wolf?
Pardon? Oh yes, called an eye when alive. Now, perhaps a maith eye, one of rot or decay. Or one could say an oth eye, referring to its skeletal state. For myself, I think I prefer Tai, a broken eye, if you will.
Mappo, I really don't care what you call it. It's an undead wolf, something to keep cartographer company.
He's back, right? I'm sure I heard him.
Yes, he guided these others to us and now interprets.
They don't speak Daru? Barbarians.
Yet two of them, those twin girls, they possess Daru blood. I'm almost certain of it. The boy now clinging to Gruntle, there is Imas in him. More than half, I would judge. Therefore, either his mother or father was probably Bargast. The leader among them, she is named Setok and proclaimed by Gruntle to be the destrient of the wolves, reminds me of a Khanis, though she is not. Some scenes painted on the oldest of tombs on the north coast of Seven Cities display people much like her in appearance, from the time before the tribes came out of the desert, one presumes.